Hello, this is Nicholas Brendan, and you're listening to the Rule Zero Podcast.
From the Rule Zero Studios in High Bar Zoom, this is Rule Zero, the podcast for gamers to talk about gaming. All games, all gaming, all the time. Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome back to the Rule Zero Podcast. I'm Chris, and a diplomacy check against me once failed is failed forever.
And I'm Pete, and my charisma is not directly related to my comeliness.
And I'm Sharon, and I don't speak unless I have something that will astound the whole room. And may I say, my corset is too tight.
You may say that, and I like it that way.
Mine is too. Hold on, need to loosen that up. The whale bones are really sticking me in the ribs.
Let me get that for you.
Thanks. Oh, okay. That's good.
Okay. Yeah, all right. This is episode 22, D&D and P&P, where we will be talking about social systems in RPGs. But first, we have a major news item. This just handed to me. Pete, go.
But it was just handed to you. Okay, so basically, our friends of the show, Ron Lowe's and Scott Jones, have written a supplementary book to the Ubiquity System. The Ubiquity System is the engine that drives Hollow Earth Expedition. And the Kickstarter that they have founded for the book can be found on, of course, Kickstarter, and is entitled Quantum Black Cosmic Horrors. So if you like Lovecraft, you like Ubiquity, I think you'd like this book.
It's a really simple system. If you haven't played Hollow Earth, it's, you know, you have X number of skills, that's how many dice you roll, and it's however many odd numbers you get is your number of successes. It's wicked easy.
Right. And then the other thing that you can do is, over time, you earn stunts that are in the form of coins, and you can pay out your stunts if you want to do something really super awesome.
Right. So do you know anything about this particular product?
This particular product is, as I said, specifically geared towards a group in modern times that is backed by a shadowy company called Quantum... Okay, something. Sorry.
It's not Quantum Black, is it?
No, it's not Quantum Black. Okay. It's Quantum Integrated Technologies.
Okay.
And their Black Ops group is called Quantum Black. And essentially, they're kind of a combination of the Hunters from Supernatural and the shadowy government agency from Call of Cthulhu.
Okay. There's a bit of element of The Laundry in there as well, if you've heard of that one. Okay.
But it introduces a new magic system for Ubiquity, and it also introduces a sanity system for Ubiquity, which neither have had much play, from what I understand.
Excellent. And now let's talk about the Kickstarter.
Okay.
When did it start? How long does it go?
It started this past Wednesday on July 29th, and it will go for an entire month.
Okay, so get in on it quick. You've got, as of this writing, 23 days to go.
Yes.
They are about halfway to their goal, a little less than halfway.
Fantastic.
They have 37 backers in a row.
37?
including me.
Oh, fantastic.
38.
Actually, including me.
So 37. Mm-hmm. All right, so they have about halfway to go, and it looks really good. They've got some good people helping them with this. There's some good artwork here that I'm looking
at. Some great artwork, yeah.
So, yeah, go to Kickstarter.com and look for Quantum Black Cosmic Horrors.
And we'll also put a link on the website.
Indeed we will.
Yes.
So do we have any other news?
That's all the news for me.
Okay. Well, then after this break, we'll come back for the heart of the matter.
Hello, audience. Listen to your podcast player. Now back to me. Now back to your podcast player. Now back to me. Sadly, it isn't me. But if it stopped playing pop music and switched to the Dragon Reel podcast, it could sound like me. Look down. Back up. Where are you? You're in a movie theater with the podcast your podcast player could sound like. What's on the screen? I downloaded it. It's a swashbuckler with a magic rapier. Look again. The swashbuckler is now an evil sorceress. Anything is possible when you listen to the Dragon Reel podcast and not music. I'm on a unicorn.
Listen to Dragon Reel, the fantasy film podcast at DragonReel.com, or subscribe on iTunes or wherever great podcasts are found.
Welcome back to the Rule Zero Podcast. This is the heart of the matter, and it is a truth universally acknowledged that a game master in possession of a stack of rule books must be in want of a group of players.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
So Sharon and I were talking about social stuff in gaming, and we were also watching Pride and Prejudice for the 457th time.
Wait a minute.
And it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it.
I must have seen Pride and Prejudice at least 999
times. Not to mention it has Colin Firth.
Right.
So when we were in the car, I was saying to Chris that I love games that include things like teas and going to the opera and social situations where there's a lot of conversation between characters, like in Pride and Prejudice. For example, when they're in the ballroom or the drawing room or...
Don't forget the parlor.
Oh, the parlor, yes, where you say, and how are your parents? Oh, they're doing well, thank you, and how are yours? And
you see, I prefer the salon.
Oh, the salon, yes. Yes, sort of a...
That is so 1860.
It's about time you got up with the times, mister.
But my question, and I don't know if there's an answer to this or not, but my question is, why aren't there more opportunities for those types of things in role-playing games?
Or the problem really was that there are opportunities for those types of things, but there aren't really many systems for those types of
things.
That's
true. I think the fallback has always been to kind of discuss... Just sort of discuss it, you know, not really go for the dice, not really go to in-character interaction per se, but just kind of gloss over that part of it.
So what you're saying is sort of there are people sitting around a table and then they're talking about what they're going to do to end or to get information from a situation, but they're not talking about it in character.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or sometimes there's not a whole lot of interaction with the DM either, you know.
And a lot of times it's the people who are playing are not comfortable with immersing themselves in improv theater, basically. And that's kind of what it would be to completely play out a social setting.
That's true. I mean, for the most part, and it's easier to kind of describe action-y things, so it's easier for people to kind of be combat oriented more than social oriented, which I think if people tended to look at some social situations more as combat, it might have a different spin.
Like on the show Moonlighting, where it was the interactions between Maddie and what was the guy's name?
Dave.
Yeah, Maddie and Dave. I'm so sorry.
Right.
David
Addison, which was very closely tied to His Girl Friday, which was Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant. I mean, it's almost exactly the same relationship.
Yes.
But that's a story for a film podcast.
But I think that there is room for balls and parties in
balls in D&D.
And you know, and in other games too, like Changeling or
I wanted to actually talk about the beginning of social systems in starting with D&D, because that was, you know, the oldest, you know, universally acknowledged role playing game. So in first edition D&D and basic D&D, you had a charisma stat, but it didn't really do much other than decide how many people you could, you know, boss around at one time, which was your max henchman score.
But it also gave you a mechanical way of dealing with other people. So you could come in if you had a relatively high charisma score and you, like, say you wanted to introduce yourself to the local castellan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how he would respond to you depended on what your modifier was from your charisma score, and then it would be anywhere from he definitely dislikes you to your bosom buddies.
Right. There was a reaction check.
Yes.
And that was really the only mechanical thing. It was basically what's your first impression that you're
right,
making.
Right, exactly.
And beyond that, after you've established that charisma, I mean, it was a guideline for the player and the DM.
Right.
But other than that, everything else that it depended on was probably a house rule.
Probably.
I would definitely agree with that. I think it was also used in romantic situations, too.
Which would have been house ruled,
yes,
because there was no rule book that had anything to do with
nothing,
romantic situations.
Right. So, you're right that it was based on your charisma, but then there were house rules. But I remember, like, a lot of... when we first started playing in college, there were a lot of things where, you know, it was just like if you're beautiful, if you had like an 18 or a 16 charisma, then the person likes. So it really didn't even really matter what you said. I don't think there were rules for. It's just like, do you look good and do you?
I would actually argue with what you're saying and say that it didn't matter what your stats were. It was almost always what you said as a player,
right.
and your stats as a character were less relevant
because
of this lack of system.
Comeliness came in after Unearthed Arcana was released. It's kind of a 1.5 modification.
I think
what people were trying to get across was the fact that you didn't have to be comely to have a high charisma. You know,
right.
Hitler was a very charismatic dude.
Yes.
But not the sexiest man on the planet.
It was there specifically because they kept trying to reinforce the idea that they weren't the same
right,
thing.
Right, exactly.
And it didn't really follow over into other generations of the game because nobody wanted that seventh stat just sort of following them
yeah,
around.
Yeah, exactly. Especially since it's kind of a sub-stat.
Yeah. And it was a stat that was influenced by your charisma, and none of the other stats were influenced by other stats.
Exactly.
Now, I liked it.
I know
I
you did.
I liked it. I just thought there could have been more rules for social interactions.
I think what comes down to was the fact that D&D was originally based off of a miniatures combat
right.
game. So there was always going to be more emphasis on the combat than on the social settings.
And in that age, all of the role-playing games were, you know, they were formed and based around their combat systems.
Right, and I mean, really the only thing that I can remember that had any sort of social interaction dynamic was Top Secret. If you were playing an investigator or, because it was Assassin, Investigator, and I can't remember what the middle one was.
No, I never actually played Top Secret.
Yeah, so, but you were always a spy, but it depended on what kind of spy you were.
I see.
So, but if you were an investigator, one of the things you had to rely on was your a social stat that would allow you to question people and get maximize the amount of information they were willing to give you.
Okay, I want to find that game. You said Top Secret.
Top Secret. You're good luck.
I'm sure. Yeah, we can probably find it on NobleKnight.com.
You can probably find it there, or you can probably find it on Amazon for sale for a lot of money.
Yeah, that's. It's yeah probably so out of print it's super collectible.
Yeah.
But so you're saying that was in the 80s and that was one of the earliest social systems in role playing.
But it had a specific purpose. You know, you didn't necessarily use it outside of the investigation part of the game.
Now when second edition came out, they had something called non-weapon proficiencies as part of the core game. This was something that was added on late in the first edition run, but it was part of the core game in second edition.
Okay. And was that when you had like your swim skill and your cooking skill and
it was the first attempt at a skill system,
yes.
And it had social things that depended on your charisma score, and you had a modifier depending on, you know, actually it wasn't dependent on the situation, it was really dependent on how easy the game designers thought that skill ought to
now,
be.
Now, is that also when Bluff and Intimidation came out, or was that later?
No, that's third edition. Although Intimidation was a non-weapon proficiency.
Yeah, I really liked that when Intimidation,
which was based on your charisma
and
which,
sense motive, came into it.
Well, the Intimidation came into play also in first edition because you could make an opponent make a morale check.
That's true, and morale checks. But the morale check was not based on your charisma; it was based on how badly
you
were
beaten. But you did have a percentage in your stat that would allow you to modify morale.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't remember that, but I'm not
right because nobody went to that sort of thing.
It was more fun to beat things to death than to chase them away.
Well, no, exactly. But I mean, like the core of D&D is killing things and taking their stuff. You know, it's not having balls and fates.
Right.
Right.
Well,
originally, but I think more girls would. This is just my opinion that I think for me, I'm in it for the combat. I like combat, but I also like a balance of social interaction too.
Oh no, and sure. I think as we grow older, we like that too. I mean, I definitely have found a certain charm in that far more than just the hack and slash.
Well, may I just say that I think it takes courage for a man to admit that, so I. But you
I don't
are
think
very
it takes courage for a man to.
I don't think most men would admit that they like tea parties and soirees and. I
don't know anybody that doesn't like tea parties.
I don't know anybody who doesn't either.
I love a good tea
party. I think Chris would prefer a coffee party.
I also like a good fancy ball and a decent fete.
Yeah.
Well, I do remember in first edition D&D. Didn't they have tables for men if they wanted to, how shall we say this, visit a certain type of woman?
Are we going back to the prostitute table?
No, they didn't. They didn't have an interaction of that line. They gave you a variety of what the different prostitutes available were.
I know there was like a street side something of
there was a streetwise doxy, a spoiled courtesan. Mm-hmm.
But there was also an aged madam and a greasy pimp or something like that.
Yes,
I don't think there were any men.
And there was also a
trollop
and things like that.
Right.
Where's the list for us ladies?
Well, you can talk to the pimp, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think I'm going to make a list and send it to a D&D company.
I don't see why you wouldn't just have a madam also be able to have boys in the same positions.
Yeah.
You know?
It just seemed like it was very gender specific.
D&D is equal opportunity.
Yes.
Role playing is open to everybody.
The other thing I think, even with the advent of third edition, where you do have social skills, you know, where you have intimidate,
right,
and bluff, and all the other things, is that
and sense motive,
and
diplomacy. Diplomacy was the other one.
Yeah, I think a lot of people could work the combat feats and the combat-oriented skills into something a little more synergistic, more easily than they could with the social skills.
So you're saying you thought the rules were flexible enough to do that?
I feel that again, that at its core, even third edition was primarily combat-oriented. I think it was a lot easier to min-max in 3rd edition.
Yeah.
If you wanted a Hell on Wheels fighter.
And well, 4, edition 4, I thought was totally combat.
Oh, no, totally. Yeah, no.
They took out everything
that was made for people converting from computer games to tabletop. Yeah. But, you know, the 10-hour-long combats, I think there was sort of kind of over the top.
Well, we had that same conversation. I mean, there was 10-hour combats in D&D. In 3rd edition, there was 10-hour combats in 4th edition. I mean, I don't think 4th edition... I think it was made to streamline the encounter, but I don't think it succeeded at that.
No. No, it did not. But again, it's I think a lot of the game that you choose, even taking into consideration the 3rd edition kind of allowed for more social interactions, there just wasn't as many opportunities.
Right. And if I can make an assertion that is based on all of these facts that I'm just making up now as I speak.
There you go.
Second edition really depended on how the player portrayed the character.
True.
So you could have an 18 charisma, but if, you know, you talked badly or had a speech impediment, you know, then your character talked badly and had a speech impediment.
Oh, okay.
And it seemed to me that it was very hard to portray a fast-talking, charismatic character if you yourself was not fast-talking and charismatic.
Right.
Whereas what happened in 3rd edition was they added these skills so that there were numerical values for this. So if your dungeon master or game master, as later came along for Pathfinder, was considerate enough to allow you to play something that you could not personify, there were numbers for it.
Okay. And I think that is a good thing, because that's the point of a role-playing situation. Do I really want to role-play myself in a game? I'm kind of split down this issue.
I know, so am I too.
I'm split, because it's important to do the role-playing, but fast-talking is a difficult thing for me. I really have to think a long time about what I'm going to say. So if somebody says, okay, well, give me an example of what you mean by fast-talking, I don't mind saying something like, okay, in a fast-talking way, I say, oh, well, what do you think? The knife is in this loaf of bread? I'm sorry, Pete, I just borrowed from...
That was the game he was in.
Yes. That was the game that I was actually in, yeah.
I did, but I thought of that example when...
and I believe I said those exact words.
Yes. Or Chris. It was either you or Chris.
Yeah, it was you or Chris.
That
I can't remember.
It was me.
But it was like a 30 bluff.
Yes.
What do you bluff? I tell the actual truth that we're smuggling weapons in this bread.
Yes.
What, do you think there's weapons in this bread? Yeah. No.
And it was hysterical, but I think it was based on both things. It was based on the score, and it was based on sort of what you said.
And how you said
and
it, yeah.
Because I think both are important. It's almost like when you make chocolate milk. The milk is important, and the chocolate is important. And
it's how you stir it.
And then it's how you stir it. But if somebody...
Wow, that's a perfect metaphor. I love it.
I like your example, Chris, of if somebody has a stuttering problem or a speech impediment, I don't think it's fair game to penalize them for not being able to do something that their character would do. So I think the GM has to be aware of that.
It isn't. Yeah. It isn't fair to do stuff like that. And I think that's wherein the need for mechanics exists, you know, where you have to let the dice hit the table because, you know, sometimes you're not going to be able to talk your way out of a decent situation. We had this one, I played a character race bender D&D game where all the traditionally evil and savage races were actually the good ones. And we had a social interaction. We had a social interaction between a dark elf and a bugbear. And my buddy Eric, who was playing the bugbear, launched into this amazing monotribe where it was so loaded in BS that you couldn't tell truth from fiction. And so he finally ended, and I went, I'm not even going to roll for that. She believes you, you know?
Right.
And we went from there because he managed to RP it out so well, I didn't see the reason. It advanced the story, and I didn't see the reason to go to the table.
I think you just made an excellent point, Pete, that if it advances the story, then let it stand. For example, if a character goes to a ball and asks, could there be a chocolate fountain there?
Good God, yes.
Let the chocolate fountain be there. Or
the basic rule for that is say yes or roll the dice.
Okay, explain
what
you mean by that.
And that's the mantra of fate as well.
Yeah, say yes or roll the dice. Basically, if somebody says, can there be a chocolate fountain there? Yeah. If not, throw your dice down and sit there and say, okay, there's a 70% chance of there being a chocolate fountain there.
Sure.
You know, something like that.
If there's a reason for there not to be, it's perfectly within the GM's rights to say no. But if there's no reason for there not to be a chocolate fountain, why not? Yeah. Why not have it there?
Or, you know, I give my top hat and cane to the butler that I just made up is standing right there to take.
And why wouldn't there be? Why wouldn't there be liveried servants?
Exactly. Right.
You know,
and that gets into a whole different level of, you know, social interaction is player agency within the story, you know, player narrative control.
Right.
And, you know, that's a separate issue that's tied into this issue.
Mm. How much control do the characters have over the storyline?
Over the social situation.
Yes.
Like, you know, I hand my hat and cane to a butler. You know, is a GM going to say, no butler. I didn't make up stats for a
butler. I didn't say there was a butler standing there, so how can you come to them?
Yeah, so, but, I mean, what's the big deal? Why not have a butler there?
Right. You know? And that's good GMing, really, allow that.
I have to bring up, in your game, Chris, we were playing, and...
What'd I do wrong?
You didn't do anything wrong, not
at
all.
Then you can tell the story.
Our wonderful friend, Bill, spent, I swear to God, 15 minutes talking about his toggle cloak. And we all wanted a toggle cloak after he described... You know, it was just a cloak, but Bill just has this gift. You know,
Bill, oh my God, does he have the gift of gab. He is so blarneyed, it's not even funny.
He actually... And similar to the cloak thing, he made up this gnome cobbler who made these really pricey boots that only the most elite of the city get. And because of his secret character history, he was able to get a pair. And Sharon spent the entire campaign trying to get a pair of these boots.
But I've got them now!
She's got them.
Can I just say it made me so freaking happy because...
It took her 10 levels to get the boots.
But again, it's one of those things where that's kind of cool because it's definitely a social element within the game and the setting.
Yes.
And for her to track that down, for her to be able to find this, you know, to make the connections necessary to find this gnome cobbler, makes for good role-playing.
Yes.
You know, she becomes obsessed with something because that's what her character would do. It's fantastic.
The strange thing about this now, the kind of ironic, karmic thing about this, is now that I have the boots, right after I got them, somebody tried to assassinate me because they thought I was my twin sister.
That's hilarious.
Who had a pair of the boots?
Had a pair of the boots that I also wanted. So the person said, but you're wearing the boots. And I said, but I'm not that person. I'm Kismet. And it was hysterical because when I first got the gosh darn boots, an assassin came after me. And I'm like, you know, that's my...
Because I'm a bad dungeon master.
No, you're a great dungeon master because you utilize something within her storyline, you know? That's fantastic.
Yes, I exploited her desires for personal gain.
Yes.
Exactly.
And amusement.
You sure did.
Precisely, which every good DM should do.
Right.
And
so, but this brings us back to the question.
Yes.
Is Do the players' skills matter more than their characters' skills? Do the players' social abilities matter more?
Well, and they shouldn't.
They shouldn't, but sometimes they should. I mean, are you going to allow someone to just, you know, walk through a dungeon and say, oh, there's orcs? I diplomacy them.
I have a friend who is an Asperger's potential person. He has very little social skill. That does not mean he's not willing to give a little bit towards a social situation when it's presented. When I retconned against the Giants, he played a cleric, and he was the mouthpiece of the party. And they came up with a really, really spectacular idea, which was they had already gone through G1 and G2, and when they came to G3, the Fire King had done something really nasty. He had encircled his hall with what I called the Wall of Flesh. And he had taken all of the hostages he had collected over the prior months and chained them to the outside of his castle. Oh. So in case they tried to lay siege, they would be killing innocents.
Oh, gosh.
And
dick move, man.
The person in question thought about it for a long time, and I could see him percolating as everybody else was trying to was brainstorming. And he said, okay, I have an idea. And he goes back to they'd set up a gate to the road which leads to the Fire Giant King's Hall and their home base. And he went back and he got a barrel of basically money and brought it to them, and he walked up to the gate and said, I want to parley with the king. And I thought, this is going to be interesting considering that his social skills are not the greatest. And the players. Right. And he walked in and he said, I want to make an offer. And he tipped over the barrel and he said, I will give you 8 more barrels just like this if you will release all of your hostages.
And what happened?
I will give you twice that if you will agree to stop raiding human lands. And the thing is that he didn't need to be poetical or anything like that, but he was still very much in character and very much in the social moment. And so we went to the dice, because this is where I really felt I needed to have a little bit more to
would
it.
Would he respond positively to this?
Exactly. Yeah. Would he respond positively to a guy being very pragmatic and matter of fact about it? And so as the result of the dice, he agreed to release the hostages, but would not agree to
stop
raiding the lands. So, but it was just, it's one of those things wherein it's good to have the skills there in place for such a thing, because when he rolled well, I could picture in my mind, yes, he was very eloquent.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I think that's a perfect example, Pete.
And things like that. And it was just, you know, it's a good plan. It didn't have a whole lot of holes in it. There weren't a whole lot of loopholes that the king could poke holes in. But at the same time, you know, I wanted the doubt. I wanted the moment where it needed to have the thing. And so that's where the dice come into play.
Yeah, I had a similar situation where I had a player who wanted to play a bard with, like, Fey ancestry, which gave him a charisma boost. And he wasn't a real great spellcaster for bards. So he didn't want the high charisma to to be there for his, you know, his save DCs. He wanted the high charisma because he wanted a high charisma.
Right.
But the player was kind of Asperger-y.
Right.
Very much so. And it was very hard for him to roleplay on a consistent basis. And so I met him halfway. I kind of said, in each social situation where a diplomacy check or a bluff check or some kind of influence check was required, I would say, what is your goal and how are you getting there? And I didn't really concern myself with the way he said it. I imagined his player with his 28 charisma was probably doing way better than the player was.
Yeah. And that's sort of what you have to do in those situations. I mean, I definitely don't think you should be penalized for not having the social graces or the social skills.
Right. And I've played under dungeon masters and game masters who would not let you do it that way. They said, okay, exactly what do you say? Okay, you said this phrase wrong. That's not what he's looking for, so it doesn't work.
Yeah,
and
that's kind of...
Your 28 charisma with your diplomacy roll of 43 does nothing.
You see, DMs like that make me think that they're playing to win.
Yeah. And that's why, going back to my chocolate milk example, that both should make a difference. And if you give a general outline for, you know, I go to the ball and I'm wearing a ball gown, then, you know, do you need to describe the actual details of the ball gown? I don't know. I guess you could if you want to,
right.
Or you don't have to. But if you have the scores to, you know, get you through the ball charisma or whatever it is that you're rolling, and depending on which game system, then that should be fine. For example, I'm blind, so
right.
I don't think that I could describe a full out ball gown. I don't think I could do that. Now, if I was a seamstress, mm-hmm. I might want to do that. I have friends that do so, and they might be able to tell you the exact style of the gown, decoration of the sleeves, the everything. But that's why I think it should be both. Maybe I could throw in a little bit of detail like, oh, there are little tiny roses embroidered.
Embroidered.
Is this like the Gryffindor slip that I made
yes,
the other
exactly.
day?
Yes, exactly. Yes, it is.
I think it is.
And sometimes your mouth just doesn't work, and I think that can happen in a game too. That you just get so surprised by something that happened.
One of the nice things early on for me was when I first started playing D&D. I used to have a horrible stammer, and the DM was a guy named Chris. Not the Chris who we're talking to now, but a different Chris. In fact, all three of the guys whom I played with were all named Chris.
Oh, wow.
Makes things a lot easier.
Can
we call you Bruce?
I would be terribly confused with that, because I wouldn't know who anybody was talking to.
Oh, we just went by the last names when we were
together. Great.
So
oddly enough, they were all brothers.
It's like George Foreman all over again.
Right.
So one of the nice things about it was that the Chris who was running was very, very patient with me getting it out.
Yeah.
You know, he knew that I had a speech impediment and that he was willing to wait through me saying what I wanted to say.
That's wonderful.
So you kind of have to take sort of things. Sometimes your mouth doesn't work. I mean, even now I stammer, you know, especially when I'm getting excited or I'm really into a moment. It really starts to come out. So if it's an important part of a game and I'm playing in it, then you might have me sit there and say 15 times before I get to what I'm trying to say.
And I think that's just something that we should do to be kind and considerate of people. Just like as teachers, if a child is stuttering, you certainly don't hurry them along.
No.
You wait until they're finished, and that teaches the children to have empathy. There's my kindergarten teacher side coming out. I think that in role playing we have to keep it friendly.
Oh, definitely.
You have to be patient.
Be
patient. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's talking about the social. We've talked about the D&D social systems and Pathfinder social systems that were inherited from D&D.
Mm-hmm.
Let's touch on a couple of other social systems for other games.
Okay.
I am not that familiar with some of these indie games that Pete has played extensively, so I'm going to let Pete go nuts on this one.
Thanks for calling me nuts. D's nuts. So, one of the first that I'd like to bring up is Legends of the Five Rings, which, if you're not familiar, is based very loosely on primarily Japanese culture, but somewhat Chinese culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the important sides of this was that having a courtly strength was an important aspect because it allowed you to advance socially within the system. So as you advanced, you didn't advance in levels kind of like you would in a D&D setting per se. What you would do is you would advance your five rings.
Mm-hmm.
And that in turn allowed you to do more stuff, become a person of higher rank. So if you were a samurai who, you know, attacked people, a bushi, you could improve your attack skills. If you were Shugenja, one of the sorcerer priests, then you could improve your spellcasting skills.
Okay.
But at the same time, one of the things that you would have to take into account was the concept of face. You had to be able to present good face and things like that, and you had a rating for that. And things that you did, either role-playing-wise or even sometimes combat-wise, could affect your face rating. And
Pete,
sometimes
is face like charisma? Just because I've never played this game, so
face is how well you are received in public.
Okay, and there was a number on your sheet for this?
So there was a number on your sheet, you had a ranking on your sheet, and then there were ten spaces, kind of like World of Darkness.
Okay.
Where you had to fill in the 10 spaces to be able to up your rank.
Okay.
And so every time that you did something pro Bushido, you would gain certain numbers of chits to improve your face rank. Every time that you went against that, you would lose.
Ah, I see.
So you could be the best fighter in the world, but if you didn't diversify your character, you wouldn't really advance as well as you could.
Exactly, because that's what, when you look at it, you know, a lot of samurai culture was about. You weren't just a guy who went out and killed somebody. You were also very good at origami.
Now, in this
also
game,
good at, you know, you were also polite. You also followed the edicts of Bushido. You know,
was there also a place for women in this game? Because you mentioned,
oh yeah, it was gender neutral. As a matter of fact, some of the most powerful samurai, NPC samurais, are women.
Fascinating. I want to play this game.
So,
I have the book.
So there, so
awesome.
as I said, so there are certain.
I haven't read it.
There's a certain important social aspect to it. So many times, you would. One of the things that kind of drove me up the wall, honestly, about the games we were playing, but most of the games we played involved some form of investigation.
Oh, you didn't like investigation?
It wasn't so much that. It was just that it seemed like that was the common trope in this in this particular system.
Okay.
Was it the system or the DM, or the game master, rather?
It was the system, because a lot of the stuff the GM used for us were printed material that he modified.
Okay.
There was a point that you have to kind of utilize face and rank to get things done. So I was in a game where I was playing a crane samurai who needed to find out information, and the way that I did it was essentially bullying a person of lower rank.
Okay.
But that was completely acceptable because I was a samurai and I had a fairly high rank.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's things like that, and I gained face for it.
Because that was the correct thing for your character to do.
Precisely, for the setting and for my character.
I see. Okay.
And the social the mechanics rewarded that.
Yes.
So what other sorts of things have you found in let's talk about Burning Wheel, because we played that once, but we didn't get to.
Burning Wheel has this really kind of cool way of resolving situations by looking at social situations as combat.
Okay.
And what you do is you tend to script combat. It's broken down into volleys, and each volley you have an action. So if you're in combat, you can strike, you can great strike, you can defend, you can feint, things like that.
But in words.
But in the case of what they call the Duel of Wits, you can you script volleys. What you do is you start out with a body of arguments, and you write that down. So say, for example, I want this guy to lower his price. And then you roll a die and you add that to the relevant skill, probably haggling, and that is your body of argument score, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you script out the next three volleys, and essentially what you do is, like, you can avoid the topic, you can attempt to dismiss the topic, you can feint, you can incite, you can obfuscate, you can make a point, you can rebut, and each one there's a rebut. So for each thing that you do, there is everything that your opponent does, there's a matrix that sits there and says, you know, like, if I use avoid the topic and Chris uses incite, or let's say point, it says avoid successes are subtracted from point successes.
So I have one question, but just to make sure I understand it. So this system is a little bit more heavily based on what you choose to do, because, like you said, you have choices. But so this system is a little bit more of the emphasis is on the numbers and what you choose. And
it's more on what you choose in order to bring down the score, your opponent's statement score.
Yeah. So not so much
body of argument score.
Not so much what you're the role playing aspect. So it's a little bit more.
But what at least my GM did in this situation was, if you sat there and you said, okay, my next move is obfuscate, okay, what are you going to do to obfuscate? And there are skills within these actions. So, like, for example, one of the things you can test is a thing called soothing platitudes.
Okay.
So Chris says, you know, you're being unreasonable about this, blah 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 blah, and I can sit there and I can say, you know, that when water encounters a stone in the river, does it go through it? No, it goes around it. You know, that kind of thing. So that would be, and then we hit the dice and we see, you know, if my obfuscate was really effective, because one of the interesting things about it is that if you're doing it in a public setting, the public opinion can sway the outcome.
That sounds really interesting. Fascinating.
So if you're trying to argue something in court, for example, then public opinion can sway the outcome.
Yeah, I actually, you know what? I want to go back to Pathfinder for a second.
Okay.
Because in addition to the things that they inherited from 3.5, they're coming up with a new social combat system, or social system, in their next hardcover book, which will be Ultimate Intrigue, which is not out yet, but the playtest has sort of previewed a little bit of the social system, and I haven't been able to look at it yet. But there are going to be, like, social combat rules that are different from, you know, bluff check, diplomacy check, sense motive check, intimidate
right.
check.
Right. We should try to playtest that and then do a podcast about it.
I don't know if the social rules are in part of the playtest, because the vigilante class is the focus of the playtest.
Mm-hmm.
And the vigilante class is going to be something that has a social identity and a combat identity, and those things are, you know, those can have completely separate aspects to them. Such as, you know, it can be like the Bruce Wayne, you know, side of your vigilante character is going to have the social skills and the influence. And the Batman side of your vigilante character is going to have your combat skills and certain intimidation powers. But that remains to be seen, and it's something to look forward to, and maybe it'll be great, and maybe it'll just, you know, fall by the wayside with some of the other subsystems they've come out with.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
What about anything else you can think of?
Well, there's Houses of the Blooded, which in which you play a part of a dying race of superior humans. And it's very kind of Elric of Melniboné.
Okay.
But the other houses are essentially the same as you. You have some kind of supernatural blood in you.
Okay.
And a lot of the play that I encountered, the GM had us each play a one-on-one session with him to kind of set up the big meeting between all four houses. In my lands were being raided, and I wasn't sure who was doing it. So I had to send out people to garner information, and I had to set out soldiers to protect my people. You know, because one of my greatest strengths was the fact that I had a wealth of food.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I didn't want anybody to gain advantage over me in that. And so once we got together, there was a lot of sniping and backstabbing and things like that. But ultimately what came out of it was I formed an alliance with one of my neighbors, and as a result of it, suddenly the raid stopped.
Okay.
You know, without him ever having to say, yes, I'm raiding your lands.
I really like what your GM did
mm-hmm.
when you said that he let you have, let each player have a session with him.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds so wonderful to me. Maybe it's because I'm a bit of a diva, but
yeah, no.
I it's okay, Pete. But I just love that idea. And I know that it would be hard for most GMs to do that, but sometimes for a storyline you need that.
Yeah, no, sometimes you do. And to do so, there's always you can always make the opportunity.
And you could mm-hmm. do it on the yeah. internet too.
Oh yeah, completely.
I mean, because we live in a different time than when we first started role playing.
And much so.
I think that's kind of neat, and mm-hmm. As we live in such an advanced technological age,
mm-hmm.
I think it's awesome that you could go into someone's dreams in a game like Changeling, and which Chris is going to do this week, <I think. laughs> and you know, and then that way he can spend a half an hour or an hour, or whatever he needs to spend with the GM, and then you know the rest of us won't have to sit there thinking, okay, I have absolutely nothing to do here, and that might be an important thing for GMs to take into consideration, like balancing whether a particular thing would be good to do online or with the whole group of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And speaking of Changeling, the White Wolf has some social combat system.
Mm-hmm.
We have been playing in a White Wolf game. You know, the Changeling game, but we're not using this system. It's a lot more complicated than it needs to be.
Oh, okay.
But it's a social combat where you start out with, you know, you have an objective.
Mm-hmm.
You have, you know, you determine who has dominance in a scene.
Right.
And, you know, you use your guile, and you use your guile against someone else's nerve to basically determine a winner of the combat.
Gotcha.
And so it's a social situation treated as a combat.
Right.
And we're not doing that in our game,
mm-hmm.
but the rules exist for it.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I like aspects of the changeling game. Now, we're not by any means experts. We just started playing. So there's a lot we need to learn about the system and about role-playing in it, because I'm not particularly good at role-playing in a modern setting. I played D&D and Pathfinder for such a long time, so everything has a learning curve. But I do like how in Changeling, the way your character sheet is made, there are groups. So you have your physical, stats, your intelligence stats, and your social stats. So I really love that part of the sheet and the game, because it's set up to where you can make your character strong in whatever you want, and I love that. I think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. You're here.
Yeah.
And not only that, but the Changeling game that you played is not the Changeling game that I played.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they changed the whole theme of the game, actually.
Yeah, it sounds it.
From you are a fairy descendant or secret child to you were kidnapped by fairies and got away.
Actually, that was part of one of the variations you could play in the original.
Oh, okay.
That's why it was Changeling.
That's a pretty good assortment of social situations and social systems.
Now, can I throw in something really quick here?
I wish you would.
Okay. I think one of the questions that sprang to mind while we were discussing this prior to podcasting was, can you have a primarily non-combat game? Can you have a social game?
Right.
And the interesting thing was, my friends and I decided to run Burning Wheel in the Forgotten Realms. And we decided to run higher-powered characters, what they call five life path characters. The maximum number of life paths you can do is six.
Okay.
And so I played a Dwarven Prince, and my friend Aaron played an Elven Scholar. He'd been around long enough to watch Waterdeep be built, essentially, to start from a small, you know, port city into the major City of Splendors it is now.
That sounds amazing.
No, it was great. But one of the really interesting things about it was the fact that my character was actually the head of an adventuring company.
Ooh.
Which exists in the realms. You know, there are named adventuring companies. And so mine was... I was deposed Prince of Felbar, which had fallen to the orcs in the past. And my friend was a scholar who had always been in Waterdeep, and so we became buddies. And probably 70% of the game was resolved through social situations.
That would be really awesome.
No, it was really cool. One of the best things we did was Luskin had suffered a huge setback, and they were threatened with economic ruin and starvation. And we went to the council of captains, essentially all pirate captains, and the Elven Scholar said, "I think that I can help you if you let me see your books."
This was asked of pirates to.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. He basically sat there and said, "Look, we can save Luskin. I feel we can." And so we went through a duel of wits, and the captains finally conceded. One of the dueling skills that I had was a thing called stentorious debate, which means basically dwarves just screaming their heads off until you agree.
We call that Thanksgiving at Sharon's family's house.
There you go. but I lent the stentorious debate to the elf, and he succeeded. And then he had to make this really, really huge accounting success, and he made it. So without anybody spilling any blood, Luskin was saved.
That is
awesome.
Yeah.
That is terrific. So when you, Pete, a simple question about that, but when you said you lent it to him, does that mean that you sort of aided him in the discussion, that it was still your character doing it?
Right. So I would sit there and I'd go, "You're obviously not listening." And I'd give him a piece. You know, I tossed him two dice because I, you know, got their attentions because you can't outshout me. I'm a dwarven prince. You cannot outshout me.
And I like games that allow for that allow for the people to assist, because because it happens in real life. If there are a bunch of teachers standing around and one teacher says, "Gosh, you know, like, we should not have to give this math test in this way," and then another teacher says, "You're absolutely right. You know, this is not appropriate for kindergarten." You know, you could get a whole revolution started. But if the second teacher would have said, "No, I think we should do it. It's okay."
If you get three people, it's just a movement.
Right.
I'd rather not get into movements right now.
Okay. So we've talked about a lot of social systems, and I'm sure we've missed some. Yes. So if you, gentle listener, have a social system in role-playing games that we forgot to mention or you really want us to know about because it sounds thematic to what we're talking about here, I wish you would let us know by contacting us at rulezeropodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can hit us up at Twitter at RuleZeroPodcast.com, or RuleZeroPodcast.
Or you can follow us on Facebook, and I really wish you would. That's Facebook.com/RuleZeroPodcast.
Or you can come and have tea with us.
But call first. And if you would leave us feedback on iTunes, give us a review, we'll give you a shout-out on the show. That would be really awesome of you. Thanks.
That would be huge, and we would love you forever.
So until next time, that's it for me.
That's it for me.
Have a wonderful day.
And game on.
Rule Zero Podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. You can use our podcast in your music video or send us to your friends and family, but be sure to mention our names on our website at www.rulezeropodcast.com. Segment and closing music is by Maggie Sansone, used by permission, and is available at maggiesmusic.com.